Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Monday, December 18th, 2023. The U.S. government and aid organizations condemn fresh clashes in Sudan's Al Jazeera state.
So far, about 20,000 people have been displaced. There were reports of panic in the city of Wad Madani, and people were seen leaving both by vehicle but also on foot, trying to find safety elsewhere.
And President Salva Kiir welcomes Somalia into the East African community.
On behalf of the people of East Africa, I would like to warmly welcome Somalia into the East Africa community.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We begin in Sudan, where the recent resurgence of hostilities between the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and the Sudan Armed Forces, or SAF, in Al Jazeera State, a crucial region in central Sudan, has drawn condemnation from the U.S. government and humanitarian organizations. Al Jazeera State, particularly its capital, Wad Madani, has been a sanctuary for tens of thousands of refugees fleeing the violence in Khartoum since the conflict onset in mid-April. In a statement issued on Saturday, the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum urged the RSF to, quote, immediately halt their advance in Al Jazeera State and avoid attacking Wad Madani. The embassy expressed concern that such attacks pose a threat to vulnerable civilians, undermining the RSF's claims of protecting Sudan's people. Additionally, the embassy discouraged clashes between the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF, stressing the need to avoid actions endangering civilians. The statement also conveyed deep concern about renewed fighting in the northeastern suburb of Al Fashir in North Darfur State on December 16th, with reports of internally displaced persons being injured by stray gunfire. Both Wad Madani and Al Fashir had been havens for civilians displaced by Sudan's conflict. The Norwegian Refugee Council expressed deep concern about the escalating conflict near Wad Madani, saying the densely populated capital of Al Jazeera State is home to 700,000 people, including 84,000 who fled Khartoum. Aid operations in the state have been suspended until further notice. For the latest, I reach Sophie Carlson, head of communications at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She told me tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced since the fighting reached Al Jazeera on Friday. She warned that the intensification of the conflict in Al Jazeera is endangering civilians and further complicating an already extensive humanitarian operation in Sudan.
We have seen clashes since the morning of 15 December between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces in the outskirts of Wad Madani. There has been shooting and airstrikes reported and ongoing since that same day. The situation remains tense and unpredictable, and as I mentioned, clashes are still ongoing. Now, this, as your listeners might know, is a city where many people from Khartoum fled when the war broke out in April 2023. So they are hosting displaced people already. And the state itself, Al Jazeera State, which Wad Madani lies in, is the breadbasket of Sudan. So the impact, of course, on civilians could potentially be disastrous, both for the immediate displacement concerns, but also for further concerns because of the state's recognition as the breadbasket of the country. Now, so far, about 20,000 people have been displaced. There were reports of panic in the city of Wad Madani, and people were seen leaving both by vehicle but also on foot, trying to find safety elsewhere.
And yes, you say around 20,000 people have been displaced, but many of those were already displaced from Khartoum, and now they're being displaced again. Given the increased displacement and the closure of shops, markets in Wad Madani, how is the provision of essential services, including food, healthcare, shelter, being addressed for the affected population?
So when it comes to the humanitarian operations for now, they have been suspended. So we're hoping to be able to resume that as soon as the security situation allows. So this is, of course, a very difficult time for everyone who is there.
Yes. And with the reduction of the humanitarian footprint in Wad Madani, like you just mentioned, how are organizations positioning themselves in neighboring states to address the increased humanitarian needs once the situation permits?
Humanitarian organizations have positioned themselves in neighboring states just to be able to move as soon as possible once the security situation allows. So they are doing, for now, remote planning from there.
And this is, as we know, and our listeners, since the conflict broke out, violence has been concentrated in the capital, Khartoum, and Darfur, and a little bit of Kordofan. Now this is a new front in central Sudan. How does that complicate the huge humanitarian disaster in Sudan that's been going on for 8 months, you know, for aid organizations?
So, yes, of course, 25 million people now need humanitarian assistance in Sudan, and 6.7 million people have been displaced, and many for the second or the third time. So this is indeed a huge humanitarian disaster. And as you mentioned, especially in Khartoum, in Kordofan, in Darfur. So it's obviously concerning that there are new fronts opening, which could lead to even more displacement and an increase in already needs of a magnitude and scale which are never seen before in Sudan.
Finally, tell me something about the resources at your disposal and issues with access and maybe other challenges that might restrict you in this huge humanitarian operation.
So we are facing three major challenges in Sudan. That's access, funding, and attention. On access, it's issues related, of course, to the insecurity and the fighting itself, and being able to reach people who are in these hard-to-reach areas, which are especially in these areas where the fighting is going on in Khartoum, therefore in the Kordofans. But it's also due to sort of bureaucratic impediments of getting clearances and visas and these types of things. So those things are restricting our access. We also have a funding challenge because less than 40% of the humanitarian response plan has been funded. And in order for us to do more, we also need more resources. And lastly, we have a challenge of attention because there are many crises going on across the world, but it's important that the international community keeps Sudan front and center, because the magnitude and the potential regional impacts of what is happening in Sudan could have even graver consequences than what we're seeing today.
Sophie Carlson, thank you very much for your time and for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sophie Carlson, Head of Communications at UN OCHA. She was speaking with me from the Sudanese town of Port Sudan earlier today. The World Food Programme and Food and Agriculture Organization warn of a looming hunger catastrophe in Sudan in the coming months without urgent food assistance. They warn millions of people could face famine if there is no significant increase in food aid by the time the lean season arrives in May. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A new food analysis by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a very scientific evaluation of food security, released today warns 18 million people across Sudan face acute hunger. It says this is the highest level of hunger ever recorded during the current harvest season, a period when more food is available. United Nations agencies say ongoing conflict, escalating violence, low agricultural production, High food prices, climate shocks, and displacement are exacerbating the food crisis. Adam Yao is the Deputy Food and Agriculture Representative in Sudan. He says hunger in this war-torn country will reach new levels during the lean season in May, when food stocks are at their lowest. Speaking from Sudan's Sennar state, he told journalists that more financial support and unimpeded access to people trapped in conflict hotspots are needed to ward off the worst.
The Sudanese people require more support, more than ever. Our immediate action to preserve the life and livelihood of rural Sudanese community is absolutely crucial. The longer we take to respond, the more life we expose to the imminent threat of famine.
Today marks 8 months since rival generals from the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary support response forces plunged Sudan into a conflict described as one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The World Food Program says the war has unleashed terror, violence, displacement, and immeasurable suffering. Despite this, WFP spokesperson for Sudan, Lenny Kensley, says the crisis is not getting the international focus and attention that is warranted. Speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, Kensley says regular and safe humanitarian access to civilians in areas worst hit by violence is inadequate, as is international financial support for a crisis of this magnitude.
Since the start of the conflict, WFP has provided life-saving assistance to over 5 million people, preventing an even worse deterioration of food security, especially in eastern and northern Sudan. Yet this is only scratching the surface compared to the immense needs that we are seeing on ground.
WFP reports only 1 in 5 people most urgently in need of food assistance in the Khartoum area has received it since the conflict started. It says it has been able to provide food aid to 500,000 people from Chad to West and Central Darfur since August. However, it notes WFP has been unable to provide desperately needed food to people in other parts of Darfur since June. This because armed groups have refused guarantees of safe access to the volatile areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we have a look at the results of Egypt's presidential elections. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you change or maintain your country's reputation?
First of all, change the positions of the police officers and even in the army, because it's not well organized. There's a lot of corruption in it.
I would like to encourage the people around the country to maintain the good behaviors in the country. And when it is bad, maybe I would encourage them to copy from other countries which are doing good outside.
Unity anyway, unity. Cooperation. Cooperation among the nationals. It can promote our country.
In talking about the peace in this country, it would make people be more interested.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The Federal Republic of Somalia has signed the Treaty of Accession to the East African Community, or EAC. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir presided over the signing ceremony on Friday and said Somalia's entrance will boost regional and African trade by allowing free movement of goods, labor, and right of residence among the East Africans. Reporter Mugumi Davis-Rakarinj has more from Kampala, Uganda.
on behalf of the people of East Africa, I would like to warmly welcome Somalia into the East Africa community. Congratulations and thank you very much.
That was South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, the chairman of the East African community, speaking at the ceremony Friday when Somalia signed the accession treaty to join the EAC. At the gathering in Entebbe, Uganda, Kiir said Somalia will boost trade and security in the region.
Somalia, along with the rest of the member of East Africa community, will enjoy the five freedoms: free movement of goods, free movement of persons, free movement of labor, free movement of services, and free movement of capital, and two rights, namely the right of establishment and the right of residence, as enshrined in the protocol.
Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud celebrated the signing and said, in two quotes, "This is where we belong."
Somalia's integration will strengthen people-to-people connection, benefiting East Africa in various aspects. As I said earlier, Somalis are already here in the East Africa community. We are part of the family, but today we have been a newly born for the purpose of legitimacy and legalization.
The requirements to join the EAC bloc include geographic proximity and interdependence. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said it's natural that Somalia joins the bloc.
The word for water among the Somalis is bio. Now, if you ask our Acholi speakers, those who speak Acholi, our Luo, the word for water in Luo is pi. Exactly. Now, this is even nearer. So these people, we are begging you to unite. These are people who are already united by God through history.
The East African community was established in 1967 by Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. The other members are Rwanda, Burundi, Democratic Republic of Congo, and now Somalia. With a population of more than 300 million people, the bloc boasts of a combined gross domestic product of $313 billion. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Results in Egypt's presidential election have been announced, and as expected, the winner is Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Securing a third term will now keep him in power until 2030. Many Egyptians expressed indifference about the election, saying the result was a foregone conclusion. But Egypt's state media says the vote was a step toward political pluralism. Reporter Angie Omar in Cairo is closely monitoring today's election results, and she spoke with my colleague Yahya Suhaib from Cairo.
Egyptian President Fattah al-Sisi emerged victorious in the presidential election, securing a new six-year term with a significant mandate. The election authority announced that Sisi won with an overwhelming 89.6% of the vote, reflecting a strong level of support from the electorate. The voter turnout was deemed unprecedented at 66.8%, with over 39 million Egyptians casting their vote for the former army chief who has been at the helm of the country for the past decade.
Okay, so Angie, for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, he will be securing a third term and will be in power till, I guess, 2030. Did he face any serious challenges during the campaign?
President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi faced several challenges, actually, in the presidential election. Number one is the economic crisis in Egypt. Sisi has presented himself as the person who will restore. But the economic crisis has undermined this narrative and left the country dependent on partner countries and the international financial organization. The second challenge is the skepticism and calls for cancellation, where some analysts and activists criticize the election, viewing it as a predetermined outcome that would guarantee Sisi's third term. Activists argued that the election was a waste of taxpayers' money, especially considering Egypt's severe economic crisis. And the third challenge is the conflict in the neighboring Gaza Strip, which diverted attention away from domestic issues and economic challenges. Many Egyptians were preoccupied with the developments in Gaza, leading to a lower focus on the election and its significance. And the fourth challenge is the perceived lack of genuine competition. While Sisi faced three viral candidates from various political parties, doubts actually arose about the election's credibility. And the last challenge is the internal divisions and limited support for opposition candidates. So these challenges indicate a complex political environment, including skepticism about the election's fairness, a limited genuine competition, and concerns about restrictions on opposition candidates.
Some voters have said that the eruption of conflict in Gaza encouraged them to vote for Sisi, who has long presented himself as a bulwark of stability in a volatile region.
Well, the situation in Gaza and the Egyptian government's handling of the crisis were important issues for the Egyptian people. Some Egyptians questioned whether the government was doing enough to pump aid into Gaza and called for an end to the Israeli-Egyptian blockade. However, Egypt's delicate relationship with Israel and its need for financial support limited its ability to take certain actions that might have alienated its Western backers or jeopardized its security partnership with Israel. The dire economic situation in Egypt, including high inflation and the falling currency value, was already a significant concern for many Egyptians before the conflict in Gaza.
That was reporter Angie Omar speaking with my colleague Yahir Zuhib from Cairo. As Senegal gears up for elections in February, some reporters are turning away from coverage, citing attacks and threats. In a bright spot, some journalists and police are training together to find a better way forward. For VOA, Sananu Tord reports from Dakar, Senegal.
At the Maison de la Presse in Dakar, Senegal, journalists share their experiences of harassment by police and politicians with media stakeholders and security experts. They say violations in the past 2 years are responsible for Senegal's ranking on the Press Freedom Index, dropping from 49 to 104th of 180 countries. Coverage of protests over the arrest of an opposition leader in 2021 marks the beginning of the decline, says Mamadou Tio, chair of Senegal's Council for the Observation of the Rules of Ethics and Professional Conduct in the Media, or CORED. Media covering those clashes, in which about a dozen civilians were killed, soon found themselves targeted. Mamadou Tio.
The journalists wanted to show what was happening, really, and this, police and gendarmerie forces didn't want the press to show that. And that's why, you know, sometimes there was a dagger's drawn. The gentleman agreement existing between us, let's say before March 21, you know, this gentleman agreement, you know, didn't operate it after those events.
Since that date, media watchdogs have documented upward of 20 assaults on journalists. Amadou Sababa is part of Senegal's Young Reporters Convention. He says one of the attacks happened recently and he found it very ridiculous. He says during a protest, a former governor of Dakar gave blatant instructions to defense and security forces to tear gas and attack the press. VOA's attempt to reach Governor Alioune Badar Assane about the incident were unsuccessful. A spokesperson for Senegal's government did not respond to VOA's request for comments about the incident and the country's decline in press freedom. In a bid to repair the relationship, police and press are training together. In a training session hosted by RSF, journalists called for increased protection and reform to several provisions in Senegal's press code. Sadi Boumarong is the sub-Saharan director for RSF.
We are calling on the authorities, first of all, to stop, to put an end to the never-ending hours of journalists we have seen the last 2 years, and also to repeal the problematic provisions in the press codes, because in many countries in West Africa, I mean, the press codes are done in a way that if a journalist is arrested, he can't be sent to jail directly. But in Senegal, that's not the case.
As Senegal's February presidential election approach, Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, has observed an increase in harassment. The media watchdog has noted a rise in intermittent internet cuts and social media blackouts as well. Sabah Abbas says these are attempts to silence the media. He says he doesn't think Senegal, which claims to be a democratic and hospitable country, should be called a democracy if these kinds of practices continue, if journalists can no longer do their jobs properly. While Corrid says many journalists are wary of political coverage ahead of the February vote, RSF says it will be there to help train and equip reporters to do their work safely. Sena Nutod, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And that's all we have for you this Monday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio, in Washington. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The long-term United Nations peacekeeping force known as MONUSCO in the Democratic Republic of the Congo has agreed to withdraw at the request of the government of the DRC. Speaking at the United Nations Security Council, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs, expressed appreciation for the DRC government's commitment to assuming responsibility for civilian protection and extending state authority in the provinces where MONUSCO is deployed.
We welcome the flexibility built into the plan and stress the drawdown from each province should be thoroughly and transparently evaluated for any negative impacts on civilian protection and the humanitarian situation. Major gaps will be unacceptable and should prompt an immediate reassessment and a pause in subsequent phases.
As in other peacekeeping transitions, MONUSCO's drawdown will be challenging, warned Ambassador Wood. The DRC faces a looming financial cliff when transitioning from assessed to voluntary contributions amidst growing humanitarian and development needs. The United States Agency for International Development and Department of State allocated more than $956 million in humanitarian aid and bilateral assistance to the DRC in fiscal year 2022, not including our support to MONUSCO, said Ambassador Wood.
We call on the international community to mobilize additional resources now to bolster the work of UN agencies, funds, and programs in preparation for MONUSCO's departure.
MONUSCO's drawdown also demands a new vision for security and non-security solutions to the Eastern DRC's 30-year crisis, urged Ambassador Wood. The speed at which Rwanda and the DRC approached the brink of war in recent weeks was alarming.
We welcome the commitments both governments have made toward de-escalation, but more must be done to reduce tensions and prevent miscalculations. Again, we call on Rwanda to end its support for M23 and withdraw from DRC territory.
The United States is encouraged by the DRC government's preparation for free and fair elections on December 20th. We urge political actors and civilians alike to refrain from hate speech and divisive rhetoric, which could lead to violence. All Congolese, said Ambassador Wood, should be able to cast their votes without fearing for their safety. Successful elections will be an important step in the DRC's effort to maintain peace and stability long term.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.